The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, an unexpectedly quiet weekend for us with the postponement of the Levain Cup final. Did you get Saturday off, or were you roped into doing other duties for Football Radar?
Well, I still have work to do Saturday in preparation for the Sunday games, actually. But I managed to get Sunday off. People were very kind that they said I didn't have to get up at 3 a.m. to watch for Galta Sendai versus Sagan Tosu. So I very much appreciate that.
Good news, good news. All right, well, the game last Saturday, the Levain Cup final, was postponed. I actually thought after editing last week's podcast that we didn't do a very good job of previewing the final, which was entirely my fault, as I forgot to give it more time in our rundown. Perhaps I had a premonition, though, so I guess we'll run with that. So we've mentioned it off the top. The Levain Cup final scheduled for Saturday was postponed on Wednesday night after an outbreak of COVID-19 among the players and staff at Kashiwa Reysol. And with us to discuss the fallout and options for the league in terms of rescheduling one of the marquee events on the J-League calendar is Dan Olowitz from the Japan Times. Dan, I know you're zonked after a seemingly endless days of watching a US election coverage, but thanks for joining us, and how are you?
I'm good. It's over, Ben. It's finally over. And this morning I had woke up early to watch my Philadelphia Union win the MLS Supporters Shield, so feeling pretty good.
Absolutely outstanding. All right, a great few days for you then, Dan. Terrific stuff for you. That's great to hear, and congrats to you and all of the Union fans, all of the sons of Ben out there. I should also fill any listeners in who might be worried. Dan and I are well and truly back on speaking terms after the hatchet job he did on me in last week's edition of the Japan Times, although he might still have some fence building to do with Graham and Richie after springing the photo of the three of us on them, very much a surprise for them, alongside the article. But no, seriously, Dan, thanks very much for putting such a great piece together out of the rambling that I spewed out on on our Skype call. It was a great article, and a very very nice of you to do. So thanks very much for that.
No problem. You know, one of the things I love about what I do is that sometimes I get the chance to highlight the people in our community who are doing awesome stuff, and hope to keep doing that. I'm glad I finally got a chance, because I know I've suggested that we should do this interview at some point for a couple of years now, and no better an occasion than this. And I'm just disappointed that we didn't get to hear your call on Saturday.
Oh well, it's going to come up sooner or later, Dan. So maybe we can do a follow up before the rescheduled game is actually played. I might make some more sense in our next Skype call if that is the case. So all right, let's break down what we know about the timeline of events leading to the postponement of the final. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Dan, but I believe that news broke early last week. Was it Monday that Kashiwa manager Nelsinho, as well as an unnamed player and a member of Reysol staff, had tested positive for COVID-19? So, am I right so far? It was Monday, wasn't it?
So the timeline is that on Monday, a player tested positive. And on Tuesday, they discovered that Nelsinho, as well as another coach, had tested positive. And when I say another coach, the team is only using the phrase staff, just sort of one of those vagaries of Japanese. But the president of the club was asked, I asked him on Wednesday, and I believe someone else asked something similar, and basically he said that they were all team staff who were sort of pitch side with the players. So you're talking coaches, interpreters, technical staff, that sort of thing. So this wasn't something that spread in the front office, so to speak. This was all field level people. And so it was Tuesday, and then came Wednesday when they added basically 10 more people.
Right, so the game scheduled for Tuesday, Reysol was scheduled to play up in Sendai on Tuesday. That game was postponed, and then I guess we started to fear for the worst for Saturday. But yeah, as you say, 10 more cases on Wednesday, and I guess at that point the J League's hand was forced. And I think you tweeted, Dan, that you knew we were all in trouble when J League chairman Mitsuru Murai turned up for the online news conference late on Wednesday night in a suit.
This was a 10:30 p.m. press conference, and nothing good is announced at 10:30 at night. Doesn't matter the time zone, but nothing's good announced at 10:30. So when you get that email, and we were only given about 10 minutes notice, this all came together very quickly. Although I think Nikon Sports actually, they might have jumped the gun a little when their articles, they might have had a leak or a scoop and whatever. But you see, when you see Mariah in the suit, and when you know that it's a joint press conference with both clubs and Mariah, you know what's up, and you can sort of tell that the writing's on the wall. So it was what it was, and each of the respective presidents and chairmen walked us through everything, and they answered questions until at least felt like 11:30-ish. That went on for quite a while, and that was that.
All right, then. So, so we knew that the game on Tuesday was already postponed. Then they went ahead and postponed the Levain Cup final on Saturday. Since then, we've also had the postponement of Reysol's game this upcoming weekend at home against Oita. So, that's well and truly off as well. And, I guess we presume, we hope, Dan, that they'll be able to return to league action when they're scheduled to host Tosu in match day 28 on Saturday the 21st, or is that that's still way too early to be making a hopeful claim like that?
It's so up in the air. They haven't announced anything that far ahead. This isn't like quite like the Tosu situation where the club just announced that they were shutting down for the 2 weeks and they postponed three games, I think it was, three or four. God, the season has been so long. But the issue is that we don't have much season left. There aren't many days on the calendar, and there aren't many sort of makeup days built into what's left of the schedule for them to postpone this many games. Now we've already got two that they have to make up in addition to the Levain Cup final. So if you think about it, a cluster means that they've got to shut down for 2 weeks. I think one new player tested positive after Wednesday's announcement, possibly. So I could have that wrong. There's been so many COVID announcements that it's all blurring together. But the point is that if you're counting 2 weeks from the 5th, which is Wednesday, it would mean the 19th. So if they can get back if they can start training again on the 19th, will they be ready for their next game? I don't know. That could be a tough ask.
Yeah, I guess one kind of silver lining for the J-League is that we've passed the thresholds, right, where this season counts as official. I think that happened last week or the week before where the, 75% of this and 50% of that or something, this, that or the other. The J-League announced that, whatever happens from here on in, the season is basically official, however it finishes. So it would be entirely unprecedented. But again, this is an entirely unprecedented season in an entirely unprecedented, easy for you to say, year. But we could end up with Kashiwa playing fewer than 34 games and this season, and that means the opponents they're scheduled to face in those games that are ultimately not postponed but cancelled would also end up with fewer than 34, Sam. So I mean, what have you made of this story from afar? Obviously, the third major in inverted inverted commas outbreak we've had from a J-League club, a J1 club, starting with Nagoya all those many months ago and then moving on to Tosu before finally Kashiwa were the latest to suffer.
Yeah, it's slightly worrying because we had those ones you mentioned earlier in the season, but then we had a relative period of calm without any or very few COVID cases. So it started up, I think it was Daiki Suga had missed out at Sapporo. He was the first of this kind of new batch of cases that came in. And then as well as Kashiwa, we've got Iwata missed, I think, 11 players this weekend, either with the virus or as close contacts to the virus. I think there's been an announcement from Kyoto this morning that they're, the goalkeeper Kato and a couple of staff members have got it. So, yeah, it's kind of rearing its ugly head again. And as you mentioned there, we've played the 75%. Is there any concern that if this increases, that they the J-League might say, OK, we'll leave it for this season. We've got enough to be going on with. Is that a discussion that might have been held, or is perhaps it... perhaps going to be considered down the line, Dan?
No, I don't think that we're nearly at the point where they would just cut off the season. So the official criteria for this season counting was 75% of total games and that each club had to have played at least 50%. So we're there. Each club has gotten... just about 75%. Most of them are over. Some of the ACL teams are up to 80 because they played more games. And I, you know, unless we get to, you know, March in the United States levels of the virus spreading, I don't think that I couldn't see the season ending. I think that we're going to play it out. And as Ben said, I think that there's a fairly good chance that Kashiwa will finish with less than 34 played, you know, unless they have everything under control and they manage to play that November 21st game against Tosu and get back on track. But, you know, they've only got...
I make it three windows, Dan. One Saturday and two Wednesdays are left, and that's all they've got from basically the 14th. Well, yeah, sorry, from the 21st on. So if they make that game after maybe 2 days of training, and remember the J-League gave Tosu an extra week after they were back training to get them ready for their first game back. But so yeah, if they miss Tosu, then they've got three windows through to play three games, and if they've got slightly more wiggle room if they're somehow able to make that fixture on the 21st.
I'm not sure that they have three windows. I think they have two.
Oh, I've got the Saturday the 28th, and then Wednesday the 1st, free for Kashiwa, and then Wednesday the 9th of December as well would be free. But they're the only three I can see.
What you have to remember is, do their opponents have windows free?
Right, yeah. Okay.
And I guess on that, the 28th, 29th, you know, Vigalta have the weekend free, so they could play them then. And then 3rd of December and the 2nd of December and the 9th of December. Yeah, but we're getting it. It's tight. It's really tight, and I just don't know it's going to be a tough end of the season for them. It's going to be a tough end of the season for everyone, and then hopefully they have a couple weeks from the end of the season to rest up and play the Levan Cup whenever that takes place.
So what would be the protocol? Say if Kashiwa do miss these games and they can't fill their fixtures, are the rest of their points determined by points per game? Or is the game decided on previous fixture? It won't matter necessarily for the Sendai game, the Oita game, even the Tosu game, but the game afterwards is Kashima Antlers. So obviously they're fighting for the ACL. If they miss a game, are they going to be punished by not being able to play that game, or will the points be made up in by some format?
I believe, and I'm not going to say this with 100% confidence, but somewhere around 90, 95, because I don't want to spend a minute clicking around on the COVID protocols, but I'm pretty sure that if not every game is played, then think it should be points per game or something similar. I would have to go back and check. I could be totally wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that it's going to be something like that. And I don't think that we're going to get that far. I'm pretty sure that if Raceholt can't play on the 21st, they should be able to play on the 25th. But we'll see.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so what does this all mean for when the Levain Cup final will actually be played then, guys, do you think? Are we going to come on and talk about FC Tokyo's commitments in the ACL along with their fellow ACL clubs Kobe and Yokohama F. Marinos? Obviously, the reason why they've been playing all these front-loaded fixtures basically since we restarted after the hiatus. Sam and I haven't spent a lot of time on actually what is to come for those three clubs. Basically, as you know, listeners, that the games have just been coming so chunky and rapid, we haven't really had too much time to dedicate to that. But it is looming on the horizon now. But if we talk about when we think the Levain Cup final will actually be played, Dan, if you were to put some money down on a date or a range of time for when that would be at the moment, what would you plump for?
The current reports and just what Japanese media are reporting that they're hearing from various officials is that the league will be looking at January 3rd as a potential makeup date. Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, if that's the case, would it be held at the National Stadium? I don't know. I guess they would have the goalposts there for the Emperor's Cup anyway. Maybe that's the logic, that it'll be close enough that they won't have to really change too much about how the stadium is set up. And there's also, of course, a lot of contractual considerations. Player contracts, of course, run out at the end of the season, but when is the end of the season and what happens if they go beyond the end of the season? Murai also discussed wanting basically to guarantee that all the players will get 2 weeks off. So in order to do that, because the next season, the 2021 season, will be starting so early, and by that I mean about February 12th and 13th is what the latest media reports are. They have to wrap it up soon. So counting backward, if Tokyo, let's say Tokyo crash out of the ACL and get back to Japan on around the 14th, they'll still need it until at least the 28th to quarantine, which I believe will be the protocol, even though I think the Japanese government has changed what the rules are for sort of returning travelers. I don't think that the clubs are going to want to risk things too much. So I think it's, if you don't do it within the first week of the new year, then the question becomes, when do you do it?
Yeah. But I'd say that the problem with that would be, say if Tokyo make the final, which is scheduled for the 19th of December, the 2 weeks after that is the 2nd. Do they have enough time there to be able to could they train enough while in quarantine to be ready for a fixture the day afterwards? It just seems such a tough schedule to try and turn around. I've seen media reports that suggest that maybe Tokyo would be asked to play a youth team in the final, which seems baffling to me, and I can't imagine that would be the case, but it is just a really tough turnaround if they do make the final.
I feel like that wouldn't happen. I think that what I would expect is that the government, the J League and the JFA would work out something. For example, I'm just spitballing this as a potential solution, which is that they could quarantine at the National Training Center out in Makuhari in Chiba Prefecture. I'm sure that they have dorms there, or an attached hotel or something along those lines. So that could be a potential solution to keep them isolated and allow them to keep training. Right now, I believe that the rule from the rule in Japan from the start of this month is that you don't necessarily have to quarantine on entry, or I don't know, it's a bit vague, and of course with these things there's always a bit of a gray area, but again, I'm sure that the league and the clubs want to remain on board, and if they're spending a month in Qatar, they would rather do the due diligence and play it safe than do something foolish and risk anything, and that makes the league bad look bad, and it makes the clubs look bad. So it's a rock and a hard place, and that's just what it is. I mean, we won't know until we get there.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, after four straight league defeats, I'm not really paying much attention to that contingency that, yeah, FC Tokyo might make the final of the ACL. But I suppose, yeah, the J-League and the club have to be prepared for any eventuality, as a pie in the sky as it may be. But, yeah, I'd kind of penciled in, not that I have any say in it, unfortunately, Saturday the 9th of January, Dan, as my most likely date, just because, yeah, I didn't think they'd want to take any attention at all away from, the Emperor's Cup final, which is obviously played on New Year's Day, which next year, the first day of the year, is a Friday. So, yeah, I wondered whether they would have enough time to turn it around for a game 2 days later. And again, wondering when Tokyo would be back in the country and out of quarantine. Of course, yeah, for listeners who don't know, the semi-finals of the Emperor's Cup, which will feature J1 champions elect Kawasaki and whoever finishes second behind them, are kept apart on both sides of the draw. They'll be played on the 27th of December, but we can say with almost 100% certainty that none of the three ACL clubs will be involved in those, and that's a quarantine regardless. They're not high enough in the league to be in the reckoning for those places. But yeah, I just wondered whether they would hold it over a week before playing the following Saturday, the 9th. But yeah, obviously we'll wait and see for a more concrete announcement from the league in the near future, hopefully. But we don't know, but they're our best guesses. So let's try and figure out what's happening with the ACL guys. And I think the thing that might take most of our listeners who haven't been paying close attention to the situation here, as these three clubs get set to jet off to Qatar after three more league games. They are coming up this Wednesday, Saturday, and then Wednesday the 18th. Is the likelihood, or is it certain, that they will be sending A team to Qatar and keeping a split squad basically back in Japan? Because depending on how far they get in the competition, they almost certainly won't be back in the country and out of quarantine by the final day of the J1 season, which is Saturday the 19th of December. And if that date sounds familiar, well, Sam's already mentioned it, that is the date of the ACL final. So, Dan, do we know for definite that these three clubs are sending a squad to Qatar and keeping another squad back here for what's going to happen on the final day of the season? And in FC Tokyo's case, the final two match days they have to play, because they still have to play their match day 31 fixture at home versus Hiroshima. That is scheduled for December the 12th.
We know that at least two of the three clubs are taking that route. FC Tokyo have registered 16 youth players to their top team, and Vissel Kobe, I believe, registered 17. So they're clearly planning on basically letting the under-18s take care of the business of the last couple weeks of rounds of the season. While the A team is in Qatar, Yokohama have signed three youth players, or they've registered three youth players. I'm not sure if maybe they're still trying to figure out who's going to stay and who's going to go, but I guess they're not quite committed on that front yet. Or granted, they've been doing a lot of business this summer and going into the fall. So maybe at this point, I've sort of lost track, but they might just have enough sort of senior level players where they can field a split squad.
All right, fair enough then. So, the three clubs, they've all played two of their group stage fixtures back in the good old days before football went on a lengthy hiatus. Tokyo have a win and a draw from their two Group F games. Both Kobe and F Marinos are a perfect two wins from two from their games. Kobe in Group G and Yokohama F Marinos in Group H. All three J-League clubs begin play in Qatar with double headers against their Chinese opponents in their groups. I don't think either of the Shanghai clubs had played a game so far in the competition, and maybe Guangzhou hadn't either. FC Tokyo will be playing at the Education City Stadium in Doha, Kobe at the Khalifa International Stadium, and F Marinos will be at the Al Janoub Stadium in Al Wakra. Both Kobe and F Marinos will have only one game left to play in J1 when they depart for Qatar. Kobe's is away to FC Tokyo on the final day of the season, so we might see an under-18s battle there at Ajinomoto Stadium with the youngsters from Tokyo facing Kobe's whippersnappers. While the Yokohama F Marinos don't have far to travel on the last day of their season, they're away to Yokohama FC. So, Sam, what have we got to look forward to here? The West region are already done and dusted. We know that Persepolis of Iran have made the final for the second time in 3 years. They'll be looking to go one better after losing to Kashima, of course, over two legs in the 2018 final. I don't know, you're probably on duty here for Football Radar, aren't you? So you've probably got a lot of football to look forward to.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, actually. It's just like a mini tournament, like a mini World Cup, if you will, with a month of football. I think the Japanese teams, whereas they've had horrible schedules in the league, are kind of at an advantage here, along with the Korean teams, I'd say, having already played two. So the Chinese teams have to come in, play the extra two games to catch up. They're all in decent positions. Trying to remember what exactly happened in February is difficult, but yeah, Marinos have done very well. They've played superbly against Jeonbuk, so they've put themselves in a strong position. Kobe as well had that big victory over Johor Darultazim from Malaysia, and Tokyo as well. They weren't necessarily the most glamorous games that they played, but they got decent results. That draw with Ulsan was particularly good. So I think they're all in good positions to qualify. It's just, how much has this season taken out of all three of them? I think the schedules that the Japanese teams have had compared to everyone else there is significantly worse. So I just fear for them fading as the tournament goes on. But at least they're in good positions at the moment. And I'd like to think all three will qualify, but how far they'll go is completely up in the air at the moment.
All right, so the three clubs will wrap their group stage games in FC Tokyo's case on December the 3rd and Kobe and F Marinos both on the 4th of December. So, basically, if we presume that the two-week quarantine will still be in effect, then, if they fly out the same night, basically, the 2 weeks would have Tokyo available to play on the 17th and then Kobe and F Marino on the 18th before the final day of the season on the 19th. So that's very much pie in the sky. And, we all obviously hope that all three make it through to the knockout stages, which would basically rule any of their senior players or first-team squad players out of playing any further part in the J1 season. But I guess the clubs are probably all resigned to that when they fly off to Qatar. So, once they're into the round of 16, hopefully those ties will be played on either the 6th or the 7th of December. Both quarterfinals in the East region will be played on the 10th and the semi-final on the 13th before the final, Persepolis versus somebody, will be held, as we've said, on Saturday, December the 19th. So, Dan, I guess from an FC Tokyo perspective, we're on a pretty shocking run of form of four straight defeats. We've obviously got three games to turn that around before the team heads over to Qatar. What are your expectations for Tokyo first, and then I guess you can expand if you like, and we can talk about F Marinos and Kobe. And we do have a question to chat about, obviously, about Kobe. So maybe if you wanted to mention them, you could save them till last.
Expectations for Tokyo. I really don't know. They're obviously not doing well right now, as you said, but it is, they remain the kind of team that, on a good, any given Saturday, they are capable of producing magic. And they might. I think that they will have, you know, a very winnable game against Perth. They looked good against Ulsan in that draw. And Shanghai was the third team.
Yes, that's right.
Am I remembering that?
Yeah.
Yep. You know, and it's, they're all winnable games. So I feel decently okay about Tokyo's chances of getting to the round of 16. I think that Marinos will have an easy go of it, and I think that Thistle will have, should have, a relatively easy go of it.
All right, then. So, yeah, we wish all those three clubs all the best. Obviously, we will have another podcast before they depart for Qatar after the, yeah, the match day on Wednesday, the, or their matches, rather, on Wednesday, the 18th. Of November, but yeah, just wanted to fill you in, listeners, basically a bit about what's been going on with everything getting set up there. We, as I said earlier, we haven't been able to pay too much attention to it as the season has gone on, but yeah, it's coming up very quickly indeed. So Sam, yeah, before we move off the ACL, you've got some exciting news for for all Asian football supporters with something very exciting coming up in the next day or two.
Yeah, it is exciting. I think I've been asked by the K-League United guys to join a kind of band of Asian football experts, or let's say, I don't know if I class as that, but let's go with it. But we've all got there's a live podcast tomorrow, Tuesday night. It's 8 p.m. Korean time, which I assume is the same as Japanese time. And that's, I think, 11 a.m. UK time. So, yeah, we're going to be previewing the rest of the groups, going through all the teams, looking at, yeah, who's going to do what, who the key players are. So, yeah, it should be really interesting to get such a diverse group of people together. Yeah, and talking about the ACL, which has been long overdue.
Brilliant stuff. Very much looking forward to that. And, yes, coming up on Tuesday, so the same day that this podcast will be posted. But don't worry, listeners. Yeah, we'll make sure and be tweeting out links here, there and everywhere before everything kicks off at 8 p.m., as you say, Sam, yeah, Korean time, the same as Japan time. So, yeah, very convenient time for all, yeah, Asian football supporters to get to get watching and to hear what you guys have got to say. Very much looking forward to it. All right, so, Dan, yeah, before we let you go, I did want to get your thoughts, and Sam's as well, obviously, on a question we received on Vissel Kobe from one of our supporters on Patreon, Mike S., who actually sent his question to us from the away section at Mitsuzawa at halftime of Vissel's visit to Yokohama FC on Sunday. At that point of proceedings, Mike had seen Vissel take an early lead and then lose it about 70 seconds later. So little was he to know, though, that, yeah, things were to get worse for Vissel very, very late on in that game. But, Mike asked... yeah, an interesting question. His post in general was very interesting and thought-provoking, and, yeah, wanted to get the thoughts of both of you before we let Dan go. So, Mike basically says, any idea of what Vissel's managerial future might look like? They keep trotting out the same broken strategy, lots of meaningless possession without pushing forward until they collapse at the back. No matter who is on the pitch, it needs to change, and I'm willing to see them try nearly anything at this point. He goes on to say he'd love to see Peter Klimovsky move to Vissel to at least give things a strong shake-up. Is that at all on the cards? So, what we've seen out of Kobe, well, pretty much all season, it's just been more and more frustration for their supporters, and Mike's laid it out there, yeah, as we say, from the away section at Mitsuzawa. Atsuhiro Miura came in, got some impressive early results right off the bat, but it appears that Kobe have settled back into their same old routine. It was a pretty difficult week for all Vissel supporters, taking the lead in both of their games and coming away with nothing. So, Dan, yeah, what do you think? Can you, propose anything to soothe Mike's anger there?
Well, the rumor before Vissel announced Miura as their manager for the rest of the season, the rumor was that they were chasing a former Japan head coach, Javier Aguirre. Now, I'm not sure how my guess would rate Aguirre's tactics, but it is that is the sort of signing that would be very on brand for Kobe, and so I feel like it's more believable. Yeah, it's never been a club that's, at least in these last 3 or 4 years, they haven't been a club that's done anything by half measures, except for when it comes to signing defenders or winning titles or, you know, all that stuff. So that's sort of the leading racehorse right now. The reason that they didn't go with him was because it would have been a bit too complicated to deal with all the travel and the quarantine and all that before he could join the team and actually get to coaching. So it was off the cards for this season. But for next season, why not? Someone like Klimovsky would certainly be an improvement, I think, on what they have now. And certainly I think he showed his potential at S-Pulse. He just didn't have the players to really implement what he wanted to do. I don't think that he's anywhere on their short list. I could be wrong, but he should be.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that they'll be going for Klimovsky. Mike has it perfectly when he says they just trot out the same broken strategy. They've done it for the last three, four years. Their idea is to become the Barcelona of Asia with this Barcelonification. So they think that is just, we'll have possession, we'll outpass the opposition, and eventually we'll break through. But they don't understand how Barcelona played. Yes, their tiki-taka football was what they were known for, but the main reason they were successful is because of the energy they put in off the ball, and they don't have that at Kobe. They are just easily passable by any team. If you played Barcelona and you had the ball, Barcelona would have got it off you within about 10 seconds, and that's not what Kobe do. And they're... The passing as well at Barcelona is much more dynamic than Kobe are doing, where they just pass it around for the sake of it. There are only, like, I'd say three players at Kobe that kind of understand that the way they should be playing if this was successful, and that's Iniesta, Sakai and Furuhashi. And they occasionally, at their best, will have these link-up players and Kobe will look good and they'll cut through teams, but really that doesn't happen too often. But they're so set in their ways that they're going to play this way. Like, Miura came in the first couple of games where they did get good results. They didn't play that way. They played as a counter-attacking team and looked really good as a counter-attacking team. But for whatever reason, he's so set, and it's him that has chosen the managers before. He's so set on playing this way. He reverted to it, and they've just been dreadful. And I just don't see them changing their mind. It's the way that they want to do things. It's the players that they want to bring in are all linked with Barcelona in some way. They need to get it out of their heads that they can do this. They need to develop their own style of football, their own brand, because this is clearly not working. But I just think they're quite stubborn in the way that they're going about things. And I see, maybe if it's a Javier Aguirre or some other just foreign manager that is going to play, just going to take the check and just play exactly how they want to without really much argument. It's really frustrating because that Kobe team should be playing really good football. They should be winning titles or at least challenging for them. So I share Mike's frustration, but I don't see them going to Klimovsky. It would be a risk for them that I don't think they're willing to take.
Yeah, they're well and truly committed to the bit. That's for definite. It paid off in an Emperor's Cup win last season. So they do at least have something in their trophy cabinet now, but it's just another wasted J1 season for Vissel, and yeah, Mike's frustration, I shouldn't have said anger, I don't think he was particularly angry when he sent his message, but yeah, his frustration was clear in his message, and I'm sure is shared by the majority of Vissel supporters. Obviously, Sam, when Miura was announced, I was surprised, and I think I asked you whether you thought he was the answer or whether he might have just been a stopgap, and you mentioned that it was impossible to bring in a big foreign name with all the corona stuff happening. So yeah, whether, as Dan says, Aguirre gets the nod next year, although as far as I know, he's still very much damaged goods in in Japanese footballing circles. But yeah, whether Kobe think he's the man to take them forward, it's hard to see. But it would definitely take a big change in philosophy there. And while Miura's there, it's hard to see that taking place. So, yeah, sorry to say, Mike, but it looks like you might be in for more of the same, unless... a strong-minded foreign coach can come in and properly put his stamp on things. Klimovsky would be a great idea, but yeah, I think as the guys have said, he's in a different way. I think he's well, damaged goods isn't the right way to say it, but yeah, not quite a big enough name, unfortunately. Although his football would definitely be a sea change for all Vissel supporters if he were to be put in charge. So, Mike, thanks again for getting in touch, and yeah, sorry that it didn't work out on Sunday for you at Mitsuzawa. We're going to come on to that result and all of the others played in the last week or so in J1 very shortly. But for now, Dan, I think we will let you go and get on with the rest of your Monday evening. It has been a good Monday for you, so it's great to hear. And it's been great to hear from you on this episode of filling us in on what you know about the Raysol situation. So thanks for that, mate. And well, yeah, the J1 season's almost over, I suppose, but I hope to speak to you again before the end of the season with, obviously still so much going on in Japanese football.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. Everyone listening, just hold on. We're almost at the finish line. It's going to be over soon. We're almost there.
All right, terrific stuff. Thanks again to Dan Olowitz, and of course you can read his excellent work in the Japan Times and follow him on Twitter at iShadowTokyo. Okay, after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will be back to briefly round up the action on the pitch in the last week or so. Okay, welcome back. Let's briefly look back at the two games played on Sunday. Yes, there were two games involving J1 clubs on the weekend with the Levain Cup final postponed. We mentioned it was a pretty ordinary week for Kobe. Sam, they had lost at Shimizu after going ahead, and they, unfortunately for their supporters, Mike S. included a repeated the dose at Mitsuzawa against Yokohama FC. Yuta Golke's a terrific volley put them in front in just the ninth minute, but 74 seconds later, Kazunari Ichimi fired home to equalise for Yokohama FC. Then after we had a King Kazu sighting, his fellow substitute Reo Yasunaga blasted in his first J1 goal from just outside the area in the 91st minute. So Mike S. excluded. Pretty much everybody else who rocked up to Mitsuzawa on Sunday afternoon went home happy.
Yeah, another good result for Yokohama. I thought they played pretty well. They took their chances. The first one presented to them by Yamakawa, pretty ordinary defending, but yeah, Ichimi took his goal very well. Then obviously King Kazu just turned the game when he came on. They were all looking at him in the box. No one noticed Yasunaga, who fired enough is fantastic goal, actually his first ever J-League goal, and I felt for him a little bit because as soon as he scored, the camera just panned to King Kazu, who had not been involved in the game in the move at all.
Right.
But yeah, I thought, yeah, take the spotlight off this young kid who's just scored his first goal. I thought was a little disrespectful, actually. But yeah, really good goal for him. Kobe, yeah, they just go on with this. They're, I'd say, inconsistent, but at the moment they're playing very poorly. If I'm going to defend them, they're definitely looking forward to the ACL. They left Vermaelen out, they left Dankler out, Douglas was out. So they're just kind of getting everyone ready so that they're at peak fitness, I think, for the ACL. So, yeah, it was a bit of a hodgepodge of a team that really, although they took the lead and it was a good goal, actually, but they didn't really have full control over this game, and Yokohama were maybe a little bit more up for it than Kobe in the way that they were pressing a lot higher. I think in the end they looked just about deserving of the 3 points.
Well, yeah, after Yasunaga's brilliant strike in the 91st minute, yeah, Kobe actually did go close twice, didn't they, to grabbing a point at the death, where Takuya Yasui's shot came back off the post in the 93rd minute, and then after the ball was cleared out for a corner, somehow Hotaru Yamaguchi's shot was deflected behind a goal-bound and, yes, seemingly headed for the back of the net. I'm not sure how it was actually deflected out for another Kobe corner, but, yeah, they hung on after taking a very, very late lead there, Yokohama FC. So, yeah, as we said, happy afternoon for most at Mitsuzawa on Sunday, but very much an unhappy Sunday for Vegalta Sendai and their fans up at the Yurtec Stadium after another, well, it has to be said, horrific performance from their side at home against lowly Tosu. Well, I mean, Sendai are lowly themselves, obviously, these days. This game was originally postponed back in match day 11 after the COVID-19 situation at Tosu. And, well, yeah, Sendai just absolutely abhorrent here, Sam, from the highlights. I haven't seen the entire game, it must be said. But, yeah, the Tosu set the tone very early when Thiago Alves's blast from 25 yards found the back of the net. Then after they had dominated the rest of the first half chances, Tosu basically put the game away early on in the second half. Alves was the provider for their second. His stunning ball around the corner found youngster Fuchi Honda in acres of space in the 55th minute, and he slotted home his first J1 goal. And then 11 minutes later, well, he had so much fun the first time around, he doubled his fun, knocking in from inside the six-yard box, although this probably should not have stood after a collision involving Sendai keeper Jakub Slovic, Tosu striker Yohei Toyota, and a Sendai defender that basically involved Toyota lying on top of a Slovic for a few seconds there. But, yeah, the referee ultimately decided to let Honda have his second of the afternoon. But, yeah, the stats make pretty grim reading, obviously, the scoreline itself, Sam. But, yeah, just three shots over the 90 minutes for Sendai compared to 15 for Tosu. And, yeah, just a horrible situation going from bad to worse for Vegalta.
Yeah, pretty horrible. They were dreadful by the looks of it in this game. And I just, as you mentioned stats, I just want to pull this up from the Vegalta Sendai official Twitter. They put up their stats leaders for the game, and it was just dreadful. I mean, why would you bother? They've got the shot leader was para with one. The dribble success was also para with one. The tackle success was the winger Sekiguchi with three, which I don't know if that's an improvement. Chance created was one. And the worst one, the mileage, who ran the most? Shun Nagasawa, and we know he's famed for not moving. So it's just absolutely dreadful statistics. And yeah, they just gave the ball away so much in that, especially the first half, and the goal to, the ball to Thiago Alves to set him away. Very good strike from the Tosu striker, who's really not played too much. So yeah, hope if they had him maybe a bit fitter, then they might be a better side. They might be higher in the table. But the story of this is just how poor Sendai were. And there was the surrounding of the team bus afterwards by the supporters. It's not the first time they've voiced their displeasure at the team. I know they had a sit-in at one previous home game. So I think Dan said they were outside of the bus for about an hour and a half just before anyone came to meet them. So yeah, really, yeah, poor scenes in Sendai. I do feel sorry for the supporters and the team because they have had a lot of injuries. They were forced to name two goalkeepers on the bench this week because that's all they had available. So there are extenuating circumstances behind the team, but really on the pitch they are not delivering. And their players there that have delivered a lot better in the past. So yeah, it's just really disappointing to watch Sendai at the moment.
Yes, indeed. And, well, whisper it quietly, Sam, but Tosu are, proving pretty hard to beat. It's a run of five unbeaten now. Admittedly, the previous four were all draws. But, yeah, I mean, they're well and truly away from the bottom three up to the giddy heights of 15th and a full 8 points above both Shonan and Shimizu, and 11 ahead of the team they've knocked over on Sunday, Vegalta. So late season they've definitely turned things around. And three good goals here. We have to, well, the third one was, as I said, it probably shouldn't have stood. The first two were very good. Fair play to Tosu. They've taken advantage of Sendai and their struggles on Sunday, and fair dues to them. All right, well, last Tuesday, seven games from match day 26 were scheduled, but of course only six were played after Sendai versus Kashiwa was postponed with the COVID-19 situation at Kashiwa worsening. As Sam has said in the green room, if you wanted to know what happened last Tuesday, you probably already do. You don't need us to go into too much detail about the match day. But, I mean, Sam, there were some entertaining games. There were some important games in terms of the J1 table played. So, we wouldn't be doing our duty, I don't think, if we didn't at least touch on some of the more important results. And, apologies to Neil Debnam. It wasn't our intention to jinx anything in last week's episode, but unfortunately for him and all other Frontale supporters, pigs flew over Todoroki as runaway J1 leaders Kawasaki lost a league game at home for the first time this season. Indeed, lost in the league for just the second time and only the third time in all competitions. And Sam, I don't know, did Sapporo do a bit of a Kawasaki on them, hitting them with a swift 1-2?
Yeah, definitely. They were on the front foot, which is not what a lot of teams do against Kawasaki, and for most of Sapporo's history, it's been their undoing in these games. They lost 6-1 earlier in the season. There's been a 7-0 not too long ago, so often that goes against Sapporo, but in this game, they really kind of did a number on Kawasaki. I think it's probably the worst I've seen Kawasaki play all season by quite a distance, but that shouldn't go against the way that Sapporo played. If you remember their game against Yokohama, where they did a number on them there with the false nine, where they played Arano up front. So they did the same in this one. It's not always worked against other teams, but it does so against, it has done actually against Yokohama and Kawasaki. So they were right on to Kawasaki. They were pressing them high. They were just really going for it in this game, and they took their chances, which they haven't done for a lot of this season. But yeah, I thought they played very well. They just kind of caught Kawasaki by surprise, I think, because of the intensity that they showed. They weren't beaten before they'd started, which you could argue that some J-League teams do feel that way this season. So, yeah, full credit to them. A fantastic performance from Sapporo. And maybe it was just a game too far for Kawasaki, and they'll be quite happy to have had a bit of a break now.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, unfortunately for Frontale supporters, their 12-match winning run has been snapped, but they do indeed hold the record for the single-season consecutive win streak in J1, and, just a phenomenal season. These dips are inevitable for most teams. We hadn't thought so. We hadn't thought they were going to come for Kawasaki before they ultimately romped to glory. But, yeah, Sapporo deserve huge credit here. As Sam said, we're on the front foot from the initial exchanges. It did take them till just past the hour to take the lead. Anderson Lopez had only been on the pitch for a minute before he was the beneficiary of some excellent pressing in midfield by Yoshiaki Komai, who robbed Hidemasa Morita of the ball and set the Brazilian on his way. His first touch got the ball out of his feet, and the second was a fine finish past Junsung Ryong. And then just 3 minutes later, Takuma Arano fired home Sapporo's second. Lopez was involved, played in fellow sub Douglas Oliveira on the left, and the big man selflessly squared across goal for Arano to finish. Takanori Sugano did make some good saves in the closing stages for Sapporo, but a huge result for them. We believe it's their first ever J-League victory over Kawasaki. So, what a way to do it, and in some style with the two terrific goals. So well done to Sapporo. Frontale won't be crying too much over that result, though, as they are still 16 points clear at the top of the table. That is because Sam, Agumba Osaka were not able to make up too much ground on them after the Osaka derby played away for Gumba at the Yanmar Stadium against Cerezo. Both of the goals in this game, which finished 1-1, came just after the half hour. Yosuke Idaguchi gave Gumba the lead, but just 2 minutes later, Yuta Toyokawa headed in from about 2 yards out after Yasuki Kimoto's volley came back off the bar. So I think, the setup for both of these goals were more impressive than the actual finishes. Patrick did some brilliant work for Gumba's for opener, didn't he? And then, Kimoto's volley was superb, but unfortunately for him, hit the woodwork and came back, but Toyokawa was able to nod in. So, the goals themselves were, came in quick succession, obviously. Gumba, I think, controlled the rest of the game, judging from the highlights, but ultimately they were relieved to leave the Yanmar with a point after Hiroshi Kiyotake's spectacular overhead kick in stoppage time flew just wide.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Gamba just shaded it, but it's kind of that classic game where it's like a really big game, both teams need a win, so inevitably it comes out with a draw that nobody really wanted. I agree with you. The two goals for setups were fantastic. Patrick was fantastic, the way he takes it down on his chest. He's closely marked by Jonic, who's one of the best defenders in the league, but he chests it down, juggles it away from him fantastically, and then has the presence of mind to set up Idiguchi, who's been in superb form. He got another goal here, and as you say, the Kimoto volley was fantastic and decent reaction from Toyokawa to go 1-1. The rest of the game, Gamba did just about edge it, I think, on chances, but that goal that would have been for Kiyotake, the sublime overhead kick, if he'd have won it, it was worthy of winning any derby if it had gone in. So, he was so unlucky that it just went wide. But, the let-off maybe for Gamba, but I think maybe just about a fair result. I don't think necessarily Gamba did it quite enough to get the 3 points.
No, fair enough then. All right, so I thought we weren't going to spend too much time on these games, but they were all pretty good, Sam. So I feel like we probably should mention them. We should say that over 19,000 were in attendance at the Yanmar Stadium, and there were over 20,000 at the Nissan Stadium last Tuesday for Yokohama F. Marinos hosting Kashima Antlers. Yokohama F. Marinos roared into a 2-0 lead inside the first half hour through Kota Mizunuma and Eric. But ISA Wada lashed in superbly after controlling a long ball over the top from Shoma Doi in the 39th minute. And then Kashima properly turned this game on its head with two absolute stunners in the last 15 minutes. Everaldo fired in a rocket from 25 yards in the 78th minute. And with their tails up after that stunner, Antlers won it 6 minutes from time with an even more special goal. An amazing Yasushi Endo volley from inside the D. Just an absolute corker. He's obviously got that in his locker, Sam Endo. I'm haunted to this day by what he's done over the years to FC Tokyo. He's just an absolutely phenomenal player. That left peg is an absolute magic wand, and this is just another indication of that. Two absolutely stunning. Well, no, Antlers have scored three brilliant goals to win this game, to be fair.
Yeah, but as you say, the Ueda goal, the first one, was terrific. So, and they just got better and better. I mean, this Endo goal, as you say, one of the better left foots in the league. I mean, he doesn't do it as much these days. He's been kind of confined to a bench position. But, this was superb technique on this goal. And I thought Kashima on the day, to go 2-0 down against Yokohama, you'd fear the worst for them. But they showed such character and such quality in the way they took their goals. And they were fully in control of this second half. They were fantastic because they'd had a little bit of a wobbly period as they go into the after their kind of initial revitalization this season, but they've put themselves right back up into the ACL contention. And I thought on their day, as they showed in this second half especially, they're a terrific team. So maybe it's not their season this year, perhaps, but I think next year the building blocks are definitely there for maybe Kashima too. And I don't think the rest of the league will like to hear this, but maybe Kashima getting back towards their best, towards the top of the table.
Well and truly in the hunt for a top three place, Antlers, after this win. And, five terrific goals for all the punters who rocked up to the Nissan Stadium. Unfortunately for most of them, the home team ended up on the wrong side of the result. But, just some stunning goals on display. And, the talking points keep coming, Sam. Of course, at Shimizu, we had the first game for a new S-Pulse manager, Hiroaki Hiraoka. That's quite a mouthful in its own right. But the first game S-Pulse played at post Peter Klimovsky. after he left the club the previous week. So, his players had turned on a decent display in the, well, especially in the last half hour to win his debut in the S-Pulse dugout. To get Kobe's week off to a bad start. Of course, it only went from bad to worse on Sunday at Yokohama FC. Hotaro Yamaguchi stroked in a trademark 25-yarder in the 33rd minute to put Kobe ahead. But then, S-Pulse turned it around in the last half hour through a hat-trick of Kenta Nishizawa assists. Firstly, on the hour, the Valdo thumped in a header from a Nishizawa corner. Then 15 minutes later, Nishizawa teed up El Seno for S-Pulse's second to see them take the lead, and they wrapped up the 3 points with 3 minutes left when Nishizawa fired in a free kick, and it was headed home by Takashi Kanai. Okay, so we've probably said enough for Kobe, on Kobe for my guess and other Vissel fans on this episode, Sam. But a positive start to life under Mr. Hiraoka for S-Pulse.
Yeah, well, they took full advantage of the new manager bounce, and they played very well here, but I thought they'd played well in Klimovsky's last game, and they named the same team here. They are back at this formation, which they're 4-3-3, which they look a lot more comfortable in. It gets the best out of players like Nishizawa, who this season has not kind of got up to the heights of last season, where he was, the people were taking notice of him last year, but yeah, he was a lot better here. He was involved in everything, the three assists, as you mentioned, and like Shimizu, a lot this season have started slowly in games, but have always ended really well, but often it's been too little too late. So at least here, they actually took their chances for one, to get the three goals. And I mean, sorry again, but Kobe are probably the team that you want to play at this time, because I'm not really sure their focus is on the league at the moment. So maybe it was a nice fixture to get the manager underway, but I thought they played very well again. And hopefully for them, it's a sign that this team is good enough that they can get points. But yeah, they weren't tested as much as they will be in later games.
All right then. So just three games to go, listeners. And again, these were played a week ago, but we want to give them their due. We mentioned that Yokohama FC won late on at home against Kobe on Sunday. Well, that was. Great for the punters at Mitsuzawa to see after they, they were the victims of a late fight back last Tuesday night at home against Oita. They were 2-0 up, Yokohama FC, after in the 32nd minute after goals from Masakazu Tashiro and then Kosuke Saito. Oita began their fight back just before half-time through a header from Toshio Shimakawa. Then in a frantic finish, Kei Chinen swept home via a deflection in the 88th minute, and Tatsuya Tanaka won it for the visitors with a superb 93rd minute header. So, Oita, well, they celebrated like they'd won the World Cup here, Sam, but fair enough, I suppose, late on in the season, you have to take these victories as you can get them. And, for Oita to turn this game on its head late on as they did, it was a particularly sweet one for their players.
Yeah, full credit to them. This game, as a lot of games are at the moment, are just kind of dead rubbers. So the worry is that these games will just peter out and be kind of nothing. So it was very good to see both teams go for it in this game. It produced a fantastic finish, the two late goals. And Oita, because a lot of, I've accused them this season, especially at the start, of not really being too bothered about it. They were fairly confident there's no relegation, so it doesn't matter. But they have picked up in the last couple of months, and this was another very good performance for them. Going 2-0 down with nothing to play for, you could easily just sack this one off or play again another day. But yeah, full credit to them. Just to keep going, I thought they took their goals pretty well. Yokohama may be a bit disappointed to have let the two goals slip. We say it pretty much every week, but it's another harsh lesson for them in J1. They get that cliche out of the way. But I think, it was a good sign from both teams, just that they were just still going for it. This is what you want to see at this stage of the season, because otherwise you don't want things to just peter out.
No, fair enough. All right, so the last two games from last Tuesday were the two draws from the round of games. Hiroshima 1, Urawa 1 at the Edeon Stadium. Shinzo Kuroki gave visitors Reds an early lead in just the third minute with a superb finish. But Leandro Pereira matched Kuroki with a terrific strike of his own in the 76th minute. And, Sam, my notes for Tosu 0, Nagoya 0 is Gabriel Xavier off bench 65, straight red card 84.
Yeah, he obviously didn't fancy it. It wasn't the game for him. He'd done his work and he was off. Perhaps he fancied a little break for now. It doesn't strike me as the type of player that you'd think would just be getting sent off quite quickly or losing his rag. But for whatever reason, this game wasn't for him and he just got himself sent off. It was quite weird. I mean, maybe it was just frustration that they weren't able to break down a very stubborn Tosu side. That's kind of what separates Tosu from those other teams at the bottom in the way that they actually can defend very well. They've got good players there. Eduardo was back for this game at the back, and he has kind of been the linchpin when he has played. I think he's made headlines really for his goal line clearances earlier in the season, but he is a very solid defender, and they had Yokohama goalkeeper Park in goal as part of Yokohama's let's trade everyone around to get our ACL squad right, which has benefited Vivar and Nagasaki with Edgar Jr. in that ridiculous cheat code. I don't know if they pulled that off, yeah, I don't know, yeah. But Tosu at least benefited from Park in this game, and maybe it was just the frustration, because Nagoya have had a few of these games. I think there was one at Shonan a couple of weeks ago where it took them till very late on before they broke them down, so they just couldn't in this game. Obviously, it caused a bit of frustration. Gabriel Xavier's lost his head. He was back. They'd been kind of pushed back early as well. He'd been injured for a couple of weeks, wasn't really due back. So, yeah, it was just a weird one, but yeah, maybe full credit to Tosu for maybe winding Nagoya up, because it's normally the other way around in these sorts of games. But yeah, not good enough from Nagoya in many aspects of this game.
Indeed. And Sanfrecce versus Reds then, two quality goals. And Hiroshima slightly frustrated to not take all 3 points here. Or did you think a draw was a fair result over the 90 minutes?
I thought just about draw was a fair result. That it was one of those where Reds started pretty well but didn't necessarily maintain that pressure that they had in the early stages, and Sanfrecce were definitely the better team second half. They had chances to go 2-1 up but maybe didn't quite do enough. I think Sanfrecce edged it, but yeah, I think a draw just about fair.
Yeah, actually, Martinez played in the ball for Kuroki's early opener, didn't he? And he had a chance to give them breathing space early in the second half. But yeah, wasteful when he basically was able to race clear from halfway, fired wide. And Pereira made him pay, 20, 30 minutes later on in the game. So yeah, 1-1 at the Edeon Stadium, and indeed a draw down at the real estate agent in front of the station stadium as well. So all those games were played a week ago, listeners, so apologies if you didn't really want to hear about them, but we thought we should give them their due. So coming up in J1, there are four games to be played this Wednesday. Nagoya's COVID-19 affected trip to Hiroshima that was postponed all the way back in match day 7 will finally be played. And, not for the first time this season in midweek, the ACL clubs will be involved in games brought forward. Yokohama F. Marinos head to Hiratsuka for a Kanagawa derby at Shonan. Kobe are also on the road for a derby clash when they head to Gunma Osaka. And FC Tokyo will look to arrest their run of four straight league defeats when they host Sapporo, who, of course, are fresh off beating champions-elect Kawasaki. So that should be an interesting one at Ajinomoto Stadium. Then on the weekend, we were scheduled to have a full round of games, match day 27 of the season. But, of course, we know already that Kashiwa versus Oita is off. So we'll have six games on Saturday, with the highlights being Kawasaki's trip to Kashima. Antlers currently fifth in the table, but just 1 point behind a third-placed Nagoya, who are, of course, in action on Wednesday. And also on Saturday, Yokohama F. Marinos hosting Urawa is another interesting looking game. Then the other two J1 match day fixtures are on Sunday. They're highlighted by Nagoya hosting FC Tokyo. Those teams currently sit third and sixth respectively ahead of Wednesday's games. All right, Sam, so we'll leave it there for this week's episode. You've probably got a little bit more prep to do before you jump on with the K-League United guys ahead of their live podcast at 8 p.m. on Tuesday. So I'll let you get on with that. Thank you again for all your thoughts on this week's episode. It was another belter, I reckon.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting episode. Good to get down on with all the news. Not necessarily the greatest topics with the coronavirus and whatnot, but it was an interesting episode, a different episode where we didn't necessarily have too much football to talk about. So, yeah, I will get back to preparation. The ACLs, the group stage games, seem like a lifetime ago, so trying to remember what happened there is quite difficult. But, yeah, really looking forward to that talk and tomorrow and well, today as this podcast goes out, and look forward to speaking to you again next week.
All right, terrific stuff then. So, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk Podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Dan Orlowitz for his time on this week's pod, our supporters on Patreon for their ongoing support, and, of course, you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up another busy week in the top flight. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.